16 here. So Cam, if Cam can, everyone can. Okay. So I was talking about how under economic planning, under a regime of democracy, if you understand some of the rudiments of public choice, then it really explains what Hayek is hinting at here in the Red of Serfdom, of the inherent inability of planning to deliver on the promises of the planners. Okay. I can't do anything about static. I mean, Malcolm says he has static. I have no idea what that's about. But the first thing I mentioned was political externalities. Also, you have to understand that in a democracy, a lot of what we get from legislation is a result of log rolling. I can give a simple example. Let's say you have three different groups of people in a community that each has a separate type of preference for local government spending. So you have one group who wants more spending on schools. These are people with children in school. You have another group that are the elderly, and they are in favor of more government spending on health care in a local government-run hospital. You have a third group who wants no more spending on anything. The status quo is okay. They're taxed enough already, so they don't want more taxes. And so we're going to consider voting on tax referenda for these two different things. One, raise taxes to spend more on schools. Two, raise taxes to spend more on hospitals, maybe build another wing for the hospital, hire more doctors, something like that. Okay, so you have three distinct populations. Let's say there's 1,000 people on each one of them. Three different voting preferences. You take a referendum, you put out a referendum, do you or do you not want to vote to raise taxes to spend more money on schools? Well, one-third, 1,000 out of 3,000, will vote yes, so therefore it won't fly. You'll get 2,000 who will vote no, because that's their true preferences. The second group who wants more spending on hospitals does not want more spending on schools. The group that wants more spending on schools does not want to spend more on hospitals. And the third group does not want to spend any more on anything. So you take another vote on the hospital spending issue, and you get the same result. You get one-third or 1,000 voters voting yes, 2,000 voting no, it won't fly. So if you just go by people's preferences, the effects of democracy should be no more spending on anything. However, what log rolling is representatives of the group that wants more spending on schools can approach the representatives of the people who want more spending on hospitals and say this to them. They can say, we don't really care about hospitals, but we will vote for more spending on hospitals when your vote comes up. If you promise to vote for more spending on schools when our vote comes up, even though we understand you represent an elderly population, their kids are out of school, and they don't care about school spending anymore. And so as a result of that, you will get a majority. You get a two-thirds majority. So the end result is more government spending on everything, even though the true preferences of the people would be no more government spending on anything. And so that throws a wrench into the works, so to speak, of democracy. Then you've got the concept of rational ignorance. And what the basic idea here is that the average person spends most of his or her time accumulating information about their private lives, how to do your job, how to get to school, how to raise your family, and so forth. And the average person spends relatively little time on public policy, government affairs. In fact, government is so big and pervasive nowadays that no human brain could possibly conceive of more than a tiny, tiny, tiny portion of less than 1% of what government does. And so, but on the other hand, special interest groups do familiarize themselves. They become experts in each government program. And to make matters worse, a lot of what the average voter thinks he or she knows about government and politics is lies and propaganda that are put out there by special interest groups, by government itself, by government bureaucrats who have a special interest themselves in expanding taxes and spending. And so not only do we know really very little, but most of what we do know is false in terms of the average voter in a democracy. And what this means is that most of what happens within governments is done by special interest groups who are able to influence the government, not even the will of the majority. it's the will of special interests. Another principle of public choice is what's called the short-sightedness effect. And this is a phenomenon whereby in the U.S. Congress, for example, every member is up for re-election every 2 years. What that creates is an incentive to vote to spend as much money as possible right now in the near term to make at least the majority of voters in your district where you're running for re-election happy, filling out patronage jobs and so forth, and to defer the cost of the future, hopefully, through debt or inflation. Okay, so it creates the short-sightedness effect, means that politicians always want to spend now, tax later, and as a result, no matter what party you're a member of, with very few exceptions, like Congressman Ron Paul, you'll have Democrats and Republicans voting to spend like drunken sailors, as the saying goes, in the 6 months or 9 months before every election, because people will remember that you did them a favor. And then the bills come due after the elections. So the short-sightedness effect means that government under democracy is inherently short-sighted. It's just the opposite of what the anti-capitalists say. They say that, well, business decision-making is short-sighted. It's always focused on the net profits of the next quarter. That's how you get your bonuses and your rewards and your pay raises and so forth. Well, no business in a marketplace competition can survive over the long term if it ignores the long term. Especially in the high-tech industry. No business can succeed by ignoring research and development, which is a long-term strategy thing. So it's nonsensical to think that you could have Fortune 500 businesses like Microsoft existing for decades and making a lot of money for decade after decade and being short-sighted. Yes, they'll make occasional short-sighted decisions, but if they do, they'll be penalized because their competitors who have been investing for the long run will come up with the fruits of that investment in terms of better technologies and will clean their clock competitively and take customers away from them. So it's government that is really short-sighted. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of bureaucracy. If you understand the essential difference between so-called services provided by government versus the same kind of services provided by private competitive businesses. Education, for example, there's a market feedback mechanism in the market. If you serve customers well, you will make money and you will thrive. If you serve them poorly with high prices and lower quality products or services, you will do poorly and you'll lose money, you may go bankrupt. In the government, there is no feedback mechanism like that. In fact, in a government, failure is success. The worse governments do to solve poverty, to educate children, the more money they give themselves, because the solution is always to spend more money. And so government bureaucrats are actually rewarded for failure, unlike in the marketplace where failure is penalized. And so you have, and that's just one aspect of government bureaucracy. In a private business, if you hire too many people to do a job, well, that means your cost will be higher than the competition's cost, who does a better job of hiring. And it will put you at a competitive disadvantage. This is not to say that businesses are never overstaffed. It's to say that when they are overstaffed, there is a cost to be paid for it. In the government, being overstaffed is actually a virtue to the politician. The politician uses government jobs as patronage jobs. The person who gets the job will vote for the politician, so will his or her spouse or a loved one or children of voting age and so forth. So each government job may well be worth 2 or 3 or 4 votes to a mayor or city councilman or a congressman. And so overstaffing of government enterprises is rewarding in government. And also in government bureaucracies, the way to move up the ladder and get bigger jobs with more responsibilities and higher pay and so forth is the number one criterion is how many people have worked under you. That's the first question they will always ask you in a job interview for any government bureaucracy. How many people worked under you in your last job if you're applying for a bigger job? And so there's a built-in incentive to be an empire builder and have as many people working for you as possible. Now this happens in the private sector too, But again, there's a cost to be paid because it does diminish profits in the private sector. And so your performance will be negatively affected and that profits will be lowered if you're overstaffed. In the government, there are no profit and loss statements in a accounting sense. And so that incentive doesn't happen. And so these are just a few of the things that Hayek only hints at in Road to Serfdom. But he is talking about real-world democracy in the context of economic planning and how the promises of the planners can never be realized because of the realities of democratic decision-making. And he also makes the point there where he says that economic planning can eventually result in government control of your entire life. If you go down the road to planning under democracy, government can eventually just whittle away at every freedom that you thought you once had. And one example of this would be, let's see the chat here. One example of this would be, well, socialized health care. Once government socializes health care, there will be incentives for the government to regulate in all sorts of ways and to tax what you eat and drink. They will want you to exercise. You know, can mandatory exercise be far behind? Mandatory treadmills be far behind if New York City goes the way of regulating salt intake and fat intake and how big a drink you can buy at Starbucks? Well, why not do that? What you weigh, the government will use its domination of healthcare to try to penalize you for weighing too much or weighing too little. It will tell you what kind of medical care you can have based on your behavior. Your behavior has to meet the criterion that the government bureaucrats say is necessary. I can recall, for example, in the early 90s when the Clintons attempted to socialize healthcare in America, there was a speech that Hillary Clinton gave where she was referring to a news item where a healthy man in his mid-80s who was in good shape and good health, except for his heart, his good physical shape, had open-heart surgery, and it was successful. So they saved his life with open-heart surgery. Hillary Clinton's response to that was to say, that's the kind of waste that will not be allowed under our system. And so once you go down the road of socialized health care, literally your life is in the hands of government bureaucrats. And that is a form of economic planning, of course, because after all, the ridiculous argument is being made now in the U.S. that if only we create a government-run monopoly in healthcare, costs will go down. The crude version of this argument is that emergency room care is very expensive. Therefore, if we just put the government in charge of everything in healthcare, it would be cheaper. That would be, of course, the first time in the history of the world that putting government in charge of the entire industry actually made the cost go down and not up for that. And so just that one example, I think, is a good example of what Hayek is talking about when he says economic planning can lead to government control of your whole life. Von Mises made a statement about this in his famous book, Human Action, in a chapter on the consumer. There's a chapter on the market. It's called The Market, title of the chapter. And when he's talking about the consumer, he talks about the slippery slope of regulating things like smoking or drinking in the name of preserving your health. And that is regulating them by the government. And he makes the point that, if you buy into this argument that it is legitimate for the government to control what you put in your body, well then, isn't it also just as legitimate for the government to control what you put in your mind? Because after all, polluting your mind is arguably even more dangerous than polluting your body with cigarettes or alcohol or something like that. And so, you know, once you give up the ghost, as the saying goes, once you say, okay, we will acquiesce in the government controlling our consumption of alcohol or cigarettes or sugary treats, then the government will keep going. They will want to control just about everything you consume in your body and your mind. And there goes your free speech. And so, and that's a warning that Von Mises made in Human Action. Hayek also touches on the topic of the freedom to work. And he's talking about a planned society, but of course that's always a matter of degree, of how planned we are. And labor markets are very heavily regulated in the United States. And for example, there are hundreds of occupations that are regulated by government with occupational licensing. And there's a pretty good literature on this, on occupational licensing, the economics of occupational licensing. And there have been articles in the academic journals for many, many years. And basically what the literature says is that, and this is especially prevalent in healthcare, occupational licensing, what the literature basically says is that, yes, you can point to legitimate quality reasons for licensing doctors and lawyers and other kinds of professionals. But for the most part, most licensing regimes run by government have been used or eventually been used to create barriers of entry into the occupation. Just look at medical school, how tough it is to get into medical school. We have sort of quota systems run by state governments give out licensing authority to the medical societies, and they put the powers of government behind it, and they limit the amount of medical school graduates we can have. A famous example is taxi cab drivers in New York City. In New York City, if you were to go online and Google cost of a taxi medallion in New York City, they're called medallions, M-E-D-A-L-L-I-O-N, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. You might have to come up with, say, $400,000 to be a cab driver in New York City. And so a lot of the cabbies have to do is they can share these medallions. You might get two guys from Pakistan who come to America and work very hard to save up $15,000 or $20,000 a piece, and then use that $35,000 or $40,000 as a down payment on a loan from a bank to get the medallion. If they bid on the medallion, it costs maybe $400,000. And of course that's a valuable asset. They can sell that medallion. And so a bank will lend them the money on the collateral of the medallion. But that certainly would create a barrier to entry. Now, there are lots of cabs in New York City, but there would be more cabs and probably better quality cabs if we didn't have this system. And we have similar regulations in hundreds of occupations around the world. And so it creates a barrier to entry in what you can do to pursue whatever career you want. And of course, government did begin regulating wages and working conditions and hours in the U.S. in a big way in the 1930s. You could probably fill a good library up with books on labor law, the actual laws regarding labor, not just minimum wage laws, but maximum hour laws, and of course, almost all aspects of bargaining between employers and employees are regulated by federal, state, or local governments in some way or another. And so so the freedom to work is all relative. We have relative freedom to work, but we also have, in the U.S., a regimented work system. Some other countries have more regulations. For a long, long time, Europe, most of the European democracies have been known to have more mandates than we do here in the United States. Not only minimum wage mandates, but mandates to employers to provide certain types of health care. Or I think at one point in Germany there was a mandatory 2-week spa vacation for employees of corporations. I don't know if this still exists, but it did maybe 10 or 12 years ago when I researched it. And of course, there's nothing wrong with negotiating a 2-week vacation at a health spa with your employer, but some employees may prefer. So, say a young employee who wants to save up money to buy his or her first house may prefer to work that 2 weeks and make extra money for that down payment. Not everyone wants a 2-week health spa vacation. And so the government, again, forces a one-size-fits-all regime on the whole workforce when it passes laws like that. And of course, all of these nice-sounding things make it more costly to hire employees. And when you make it more costly to hire employees, fewer employees will be hired. That's called the law of demand as it applies to labor markets. And so for a long, long time, the Europeans have, democracies have been known for having very lethargic, if not non-existent, job growth. And this is bound to be one of the reasons. The government mandates push up the price of labor, and therefore employers find it uneconomical to hire more people because not only do they have to pay them a competitive wage, but all these added government-imposed benefits. you cannot benefit, you cannot, government cannot mandate benefits without also mandating costs on somebody else, namely employers. And so, so we do have, and these things all came about in a much bigger way after Hayek wrote the Road to Serfdom. And now Hayek here, you know, keep in mind this is in the 1940s, and he's mocking the idea that socialism or planning will result in greater prosperity. No one argues this anymore. No one argues that socialism will, or planning, government planning, whatever you want to call it, will create more prosperity. No serious person can argue that. Although there are some people who are trying to slip by under the radar by calling, using various euphemisms for socialist central planning, like sustainable development, for example. That's a big one with environmentalists. If you want to, one of my articles on this recently that I think I mentioned last week was entitled "The Watermelon Summit." It was on BlueRockwell.com a few weeks ago about the recent Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. But now the socialists of today have given up essentially on saying socialism will create more prosperity. But what they're saying now is that well, prosperity is bad for you. It's, we don't want prosperity. And another thing they're saying is that, well, government may not create prosperity, but it will make you happy. It will make you happy. Socialism will make you happy. And there are several books that have been much more popular in Europe so far, more so than America, but it's gaining steam in America. And these are the books I mentioned earlier on the chat. It's The Spirit Level is one of them. And the other one is Affluenza, that makes the case that affluence is a sickness, like influenza, like having the flu, affluenza. And here's the, here's a critique of this idea by an author named Christopher Snowden. He's a British author. It's S-N-O-W-D-O-N. It's Christopher Snowden. The book is entitled The Spirit Level Delusion, Fact-Checking the Left's New Theory of Everything. And the new theory is based on one of the worst examples of the abuse of statistics by phony scientists. And the Spirit Level is written by several epidemiologists who basically have simple statistical correlations between all sorts of things, child morbidity rates and how big government is. And they basically claim that the more socialistic is a society, the happier people will be. You know, and the more socialistic, meaning the more equal. The more the government attempts to force material equality on a society through income taxation and income redistribution, the happier they will be. And so they purport to find, to have an index of material equality that has been forced by the Swedish government or the British government or whatever. And they claim that it cures just about everything. People are thinner instead of fatter. They're happier, they're smarter, their children are smarter, everything is wonderful, the more forced income redistribution there is. And so the prosperity is schmosterity is their slogan. And we don't want prosperity. We want, well, we want to just take as much money away from the productive people, the most productive people in society, and just give it to the least productive people in society, and that will make everybody happier. That's sort of the theme of this. And my article on it, The Trojan Horse of Happiness Research, that I've mentioned, I talked about this. But here's what Christopher Snowden says about this. He says, and I'm quoting, "Apologists for Marxism have made myriad excuses for their ideology's failure to provide the same standard of living and liberty as was enjoyed in capitalist nations. Until recently, few have been so brazen as to claim that lowering living standards and curtailing freedom were the intended consequences, let alone that people would be happier with less of either. So less freedom and less prosperity supposedly makes you happier, according to this literature." And he goes on to say, in that sense, books like The Spirit Level represent a departure for the left. Limiting choice, reducing wealth, and lowering aspirations are now openly advocated as desirable ends in itself. So we should want to make us ourselves poorer and less free, is what they're saying. And some examples of how really stupid some of this literature is. Here are some published conclusions of this literature that is written in a journal article in the Journal of Economic Literature, which is supposedly a very prestigious journal, by Bruno Frey and a co-author named Stutzer. Bruno Frey is spelled F-R-E-Y, is a pretty well-known economist in Switzerland. And he's one of the leaders in the economics profession of this research. And so it's very fancy-looking statistical manipulation to come up with these types of conclusions. And I'm going to read a few of them directly from these articles. Persons with higher income have more opportunities to achieve what they desire. British lottery winners reported higher mental well-being in the following year after winning the lottery. There is more to subjective well-being than just income. On average, persons living in rich countries are happier than those living in poor countries. Who would ever have thought? Happiness of unemployed persons is much lower than that of employed persons. Experiencing unemployment makes people very unhappy. And so, and on and on and on. And of course, most of these researchers call for government programs to increase unemployment and so forth. And here's one. Happy people smile more during social interactions. So when you look into this, the literature, it's really basically the socialists of today have given up on the argument that Hayek is paying all this attention to. They no longer argue that prosperity is even a good thing. They're saying it's a bad thing. It's socialism is what we want, forced redistribution of income. And keep in mind, I think the statement I made on the first night is that in the 1976 edition of The Road to Serfdom, Hayek pointed out in his preface that socialism started out being defined as government ownership of the means of production. But then, within a couple of decades in the 20th century, it came to be known as forced income redistribution through the auspices of the welfare state and progressive income taxation. That's what socialism was about, because the purpose was always, the ostensible purpose anyway, was always to try to force material equality on the society. And so the socialists decided that it was too hard to do it by taking over industry, because after all, what do these academic eggheads know about running steel mills and automobile factories? Nothing. And so that could be a disaster. So they'd rather regulate them and control them and try to achieve socialism or egalitarianism through taxation and the welfare state. And so that's, I thought I'd bring that point up. In the eighth chapter, Hayek gives a good quote here about property. It's on page 115, where he says, he's talking, of course, in the 1940s, and he says, what our generation has forgotten is that the system of private property is the most important guarantee of freedom, not only for those who own property, but scarcely less for those who do not own property. It is only because the control of the means of production is divided among many people acting independently that nobody has complete power over us, that we as individuals can decide what to do with ourselves in our own lives. Okay, so it's only under socialism where the government claims to own or control all the means of production that you have a few people who do have control over your whole life. But as long as it's private property, we all have much more greater control over all our lives, and we don't have to own that property. As long as the people who give us our bread from the bakery and our milk from the farm and our meat from the farm and our automobiles from the automobile factory, as long as they can own property and use that property to produce all these things for us in return for our money, then we're much freer and we're much more prosperous. And I also dug up a complimentary quote here from Ludwig von Mises in liberalism on the whole subject of the link between private property and freedom. And here's what Mises said in liberalism. He said, private property creates for the individual a sphere in which he is free of the state. You can be your own boss, private property. It sets limits to the operation of the authoritarian will. It allows other forces to arise side by side with and in opposition to political power. It thus becomes the basis of all these activities that are free from violent interference on the part of the state. It is a soil in which the seeds of freedom are nurtured and in which the autonomy of the individual and ultimately all intellectual material progress are rooted. Private property. That's why it's all socialists of all types, whether they call themselves fascists, socialists, communists, sustainable development theorists, doesn't matter, attacking private property is always their primary goal. And not necessarily destroying the idea of private property, but allowing the government to control and order you around and tell you how you can use your property. And of course, most liberals, like Mises, would say that, well, there are illegitimate uses of your property. I cannot legitimately use my car to run you over, for example. And Mises would say an important role of government is to have laws that say murder by automobile of that sort is illegal and is punishable. And of course, so it doesn't mean carte blanche use of your property. It's nonviolent use of property. And so this is what Hayek is talking about, pointing out in the beginning of chapter 8. And there's another chapter, quote from page 119, that is also important, I think, here, about politics, the nature of politics. He says, you know, under a regime where we have the politicization of society, a planned society, under democracy, he says, as the coercive power of the state will alone, in such a situation, decide who is to have what, the only power worth having will be a share in the exercise of this directing power. So, in other words, he says this a little differently in one of his later books. He says, under socialism or planned economy, the only power worth having is political power. And so, and what he is talking about here is the old knowledge, the old understanding that there are basically two ways to make money, to prosper in an economy. One is to produce goods or services for sale to your fellow man. And two is to try to manipulate the levers of the state to transfer, to use the coercive power of the state to forcefully transfer money out of the pockets of other people and into your pocket. Protectionist tariffs, monopoly franchises, government subsidies to you at the expense of other people, things like that. So you can use politics to prosper. You know, if you're in the mouse trap business, you manufacture mouse traps. One way to make money is to build a good mouse trap. Another way to make money is to lobby the legislature to ban the importation of all foreign manufactured mouse traps. You'll reduce competition, you'll drive up the price, and you'll be able to sell it for more money, for a higher price, and make more money as a result. And so that's what Hayek is referring to in that. That in that type of society, the more politicized society becomes, the more it's true that the only power worth having is political power. Now, one ramification of that is that more and more people, when they acquire their education, their skill, their experience, will go the route of becoming skilled at influencing politics as opposed to becoming skilled at actually making something. So you have more and more young people getting law degrees or degrees in political science and fewer getting degrees in engineering and business administration and accounting, you know, being part of the capitalist enterprise. And more people getting degrees in public relations, law, politics, things like that, influencing government. And the opportunity cost of that, to use an economic phrase, is that we will all become poorer because instead of concentrating on producing more and more wealth, we will be more and more concentrating on redistributing the existing amount of wealth from one group to another group. And so the more society is involved in that sort of, it's called rent seeking in the Ministry of Economics, I like to call it plunder seeking, the more of that we have, the poorer everybody is. Another important point that Mises makes here, he talks about how socialists of all types, whether they call themselves fascist, socialist, or whatever, have always focused on the indoctrination of children into their creed. And you know, one article that's kind of entertaining that I wrote many years ago on that touches on this is entitled National Service, a Solution in Search of a Problem. And it was on fee.org. It was published on fee.org. It was an old article I wrote, I think, in the early 90s. about so-called national service. And at the time, excuse me, at the time, you had a lot of leftists in America, as well as right-wingers, so-called, like William F. Buckley Jr., arguing for compulsory national service, not military service necessarily, but forcing every 18 and 19-year-old into some sort of government-run program of service, whatever that is. And at the end of this article, the thing that I think that you might find entertaining if you looked at it up, is I've dug up several books on other countries that have done this, that have forced young people to get involved in some sort of government service program. And I included all these quotes that were sounded almost identical to what Buckley and the others were saying at the time. And then at the very end of the article, I revealed that the books that I was quoting were books about the Hitler Youth in Germany in the 1930s, and they were making almost all the same arguments. And that's probably what Hayek is referring to here, because he witnessed this. I mean, he read about this, and he saw it with his own eyes of these socialist governments of Europe in his day, corralling all the young people and indoctrinating them in their creed. And the U.S. government at all levels does a good job of this. It's called, we started calling it political correctness about 20 years ago in the U.S., and it really is very thorough as far as that goes. I have economic students who just cannot comprehend a concept like price elasticity of demand. They just can't get it, cannot get it. But the same young student could stand up and give a two-hour oration on the need for recycling, for example, because they've been so indoctrinated in the politically correct concept. I think Hayek would probably be shocked at the extent to which a country like the U.S. has gone down the road to serfdom in terms of indoctrinating the youth. But of course, that's why organizations like the Mises Institute are valuable. For a long time, you've tried to provide an alternative way of educating yourself. That's what you're all doing in this class, I hope. Apart from what our rulers tell us an educated person is supposed to be. And I don't know if I mentioned this or not in the class so far, but my old friend Yuri Maltsev, who has lectured frequently at the Mises Institute, and who grew up in the Soviet Union, once told me that The Road to Serfdom was a black market book. There was a mimeograph of The Road to Serfdom being circulated when he was in college. And he read it in mimeograph form and then immediately got rid of it and gave it to somebody else, because there was actually a prison sentence, like a life in prison sentence, if you're caught with certain literature, including The Road to Serfdom. And so that's kind of an extreme case of what Hayek is talking about here. Another important point that's worth mentioning here in the eighth chapter that I talked about is he asked the question, well, how would the poor fare in a more politicized society? Because after all, a more planned economy is always made in the name of helping the poor. Well, what he's getting at here, I think, is to make the point that the poor never do very well in a politicized society, just like they don't do well in a non-politicized society. Most people who are poor, apart from people who have handicaps and things like that, are poor because they're just not very effective and not very productive people. Whether they're poor or call them lower income or whatever, they're not as productive as other people in terms of producing goods and services for their fellow man. That's what you have to do to make money. And so in a market economy, there's no reason to expect poor people to become productive geniuses in politics, whereas they're barely getting along in the marketplace. They won't be as effective. It's always been the more affluent people, including the richest people, who are the best at influencing politics and politicians. So you can always expect a planned economy under a democracy to be very heavily influenced by at least the middle class and the upper middle class, and often sort of the aristocracy, in terms of using the powers of government to benefit themselves, often at the expense of the poor. And that's what we get in the United States and most other developed democracies, as they're called. Most of what goes on is income redistribution programs within the middle class. There's a little bit from richer to poorer, and there's also some from poorer to rich. Yeah, but most of it is sort of a horizontal income transfer from different programs, hundreds, thousands of different programs within the middle class. And that's what I was wondering about. The final chapter that I put on the syllabus for tonight, on security and freedom, Hayek here is talking in a sort of an abbreviated way of what economists call the moral hazard problem associated with the welfare state. Von Mises did a great job talking about this in his famous book, Socialism, published several decades before The Road to Serfdom, with some of the latter chapters on unemployment insurance and Social Security, you know, what would come to be called Social Security or government-run old age pensions. Mises wrote about this in a big way in the 1920s in his famous book, Socialism. And of course, you know, some examples of what Hayek is referring to here is the planners of his day were making the argument that we need more government control of the economy so that people will feel more secure. For example, with old age insurance. But the moral hazard, one of the moral hazard problems is that if the government takes over old age insurance, then people will devote less effort themselves to take care of themselves, their parents, and their grandparents in their old age. And then when the government programs go bankrupt or fail to provide significant benefits, we're left with nothing. Also, there's a crowding out effect with regard to welfare programs. There are all sorts of what are called moral hazard problems associated with welfare. One of them is it tends to destroy the work effort, work incentives. Why work if you can get along okay cashing welfare checks? That's why we have in the U.S. several generations of families on welfare. Welfare also created in the United States the breakup of families, because it gave fathers who were willing to abandon their children an excuse to cleanse their consciences. You know, before the welfare state, a father who abandoned his children might be bothered, his conscience might be bothered that the children might starve or become destitute. But no, today the government will take care of them. And so that source of conflict was eliminated from the minds of most fathers who abandon their children. And so as a result, we have much more abandonment of children. And we have in some cities, the birth rate of children without a father in the home in some cities, 70 or 80% now in America. And the general population, I believe, is around a third in the U.S. And it's even worse in a lot of the European countries that have had much even bigger welfare states for longer periods of time than we have had in the United States. Unemployment insurance. In the United States now, you can be unemployed and collect unemployment insurance for about 2 years, and that increases the amount of unemployment because the amount of money you can get differs state by state, but if you can get in some states, say 60% of what you were making on average, without having to go to work, without having to buy gasoline for your car, or lunch at work, or clothing that you have to wear for work, and all the expenses of work, a lot of people will just stretch it out for 2 years and start looking for a job after a year and 11 months. And so in the name of reducing the cost of unemployment, the government increases unemployment with unemployment insurance. Deposit insurance and banks supposedly is there to make it less risky to be in the banking business. Well, the reality is it makes it more risky because if you take on an excessively risky loan as a banker, say a real estate development in the middle of a desert somewhere that's highly risky and it doesn't work out, it's a money-losing proposition, and the developer is unable to pay you back the loan that you made him as a banker, the taxpayers will cover it through deposit insurance. And so if the taxpayers cover it, that means the losses are socialized, but the profits are privatized because of deposit insurance. And so therefore, it guarantees more risky loans will be made because the bankers can charge higher interest rates. And while the developer is capable of paying on the loan, he's paying a higher interest rate, and if he defaults on the loan, the taxpayers will pay the bank. And so it's a bank bailout that's existed ever since the 1930s with deposit insurance. And so that's what Hayek is talking about in this chapter, where he talks about how, in the name of making our lives more secure, a more planned economy often, if not always, makes them more insecure. And the final point I'll make is I put one of the articles I put on the syllabus was Murray Rothbard's article on egalitarianism as a revolt against nature. And I put it there because it's a very important economic point about the division, international division of labor in society. And it's a very fundamental point about economics in general, that what we have in the economic world, or what makes the economic world go around, is the international division of labor. Human beings all specialize in something in the marketplace, and they gain knowledge and experience and know-how about doing some particular job, and then we trade whatever we produce or are paid for helping to produce. We trade dollars or whatever the currency is for goods that other people specialize in, food, clothing, shelter, automobiles, entertainment, and so forth. That's what makes the world go around, the international division of labor. And of course, all human beings are different. We're all unique. We all have different IQ levels, different physical attributes, different strength levels, different interests, even different eyesight capabilities, and a thousand different biological ways we all differ from each other. And as a result, we all choose different things to do, and when we're doing the same job, we do the job differently in many ways. You know, some of us are more productive than others. Some of us are lazier than others. Some of us are more ambitious or less ambitious than others. So we all have different productivity levels, and somebody with 20 years experience at a job is likely to be better at that job than somebody who's on their first day of the job. And so, in other words, because of all these differences among human beings, of course we're all going to make different levels of income, because what do we get paid in the market economy? We get paid mostly according to how good a job we do in participating in producing goods and services that are actually in real demand by our fellow human beings, for which there's a market, in other words. And so the more productive you are at doing that, the more likely it is you'll make more money rather than less money. And so that's a very essential economic point. And so it's a virtue of a society where you see inequality of incomes. But of course, what planning has always been about is to try to use the coercive forces of government to deny human reality, to force some sort of material equality on people. And of course, it was hardly ever the people themselves who demand this. It's only intellectuals. It's always the intellectuals like Karl Marx of the world and his followers who keep insisting, or Paul Krugman in today's world, or Robert Reich in today's world, who keep insisting that there's a big demand among people for income equality, when in fact it's them who's demanding income equality. They're the ones who seem to be unhappy about it, although I doubt that Paul Krugman gives a very significant portion of his income away to reduce the inequality in his neighborhood. And he would become famous for doing it if he did. But since he's not famous for giving a lot of money away, I assume he doesn't do it, even though he's urging the government to do it to other people in all his New York Times column. And so that's one of my favorite Rothbard articles, is egalitarianism as a revolt against nature. And I see Cam put the link on the chat. So I guess I've been going on for about 50, 55 minutes here. I'll stop there and do what we usually do. I'll look through the Q&A and the chat session here to see if anybody has some questions, and I'll do my best to answer whatever questions I can. So here's one about happiness research I see from Dave. It says, Dave Graves, so by reducing grounds of envy, the government will make people happy. Yes, this literature actually says that the existence of more affluent people makes poorer people unhappy, but the existence of poorer people does not make richer people unhappy. Therefore, if the government takes money away from the richer people and gives it to the poorer people, we will increase happiness overall. And the fallacy in this whole approach is that it assumes that you can somehow measure what we call interpersonal utility, that is, happiness or well-being. But the sense of well-being is subjective. It's not measurable. You can't measure the sense, a person's sense of well-being. You know, if I'm a self-made millionaire who started from nothing and clawed and scratched my way up through the business world to make a few million dollars, I really appreciate having a buck. You know, I worked really hard my whole life to earn that money. And so who's to say the government taking $1,000 out of my pocket and giving it to somebody else will increase on net human happiness, because that person who the money is given to may have well demonstrated that they don't really care much about money because they never did much to earn much money. You can easily make that argument, as you can make the argument that the opposite is true. And so who's to say? You can't make interpersonal utility comparisons, but this happiness research is based on the false assumption that you can. I'm looking for questions here. Go down to the bottom. Let's see, regarding the indoctrination of youth, can I say a word about how public education has been used for this purpose and how the roots of public education are in Puritan New England? That's a question from Charles Roberts. There's a pretty good book on it by Sheldon Richmond. Sheldon Richmond, who works for FEED, Foundation for Economic Education. I think that's still his main job. And he wrote a book called Separation of School and State some years ago, maybe 15 years ago, something like that. So I would recommend, it may be online by now, I don't know. It's Separation of School and State. I remember seeing Montel Williams, the television host. I don't know if Montel Williams is still on television or not. He had Sheldon Richmond on his show, the talk show, two whole days in a row when he took him out. Murray Rothbard has also written on it. He's co-authored some things with many years ago, 30, 40 years ago, with a man named Joel Springer, Rothbard and Springer, on sort of the history of public education, so-called. And it is true that the origins of it were in Puritan New England, when all of these European immigrants who were Catholics started coming to America from Ireland and Germany and Italy and places like that. The Protestant Puritans were alarmed over this, and so they thought that corralling all the children of these new immigrants into government-run schools, as long as they control the government, could turn the children into good little Protestants. And so they were alarmed by that. So that is a true fact. The public education, the original impetus for it was sort of anti-Catholicism. And that was a big part of the so-called progressive movement, too. The things the so-called progressives stood for, was they claimed to be fighting against rum and Romanism. They thought drinking of alcohol was evil, so they were prohibitionists, and Romanism was equally evil in their eyes, because Romanism was a euphemism for Catholicism. So that was the first attempt, the first rationale to use government schooling to indoctrinate all the children into one way of thinking. And of course, it has been used ever since then to indoctrinate them in all sorts of things. And here it is online. I recommend to anybody who's interested in this topic, read Separating School and State by Sheldon Richmond. It was Rothbard and Springer, yes. Joel Springer, J-O-E-L, as I recall. Joel Springer was the guy who co-authored at least some articles with Rothbard. I don't know if he ever co-authored a whole book with Rothbard. I can't recall that. Let me see if I have some Q&A here. Let's see, Betty Kina is asking a question about Hayek's definition of security. As I recall, Hayek says that in a society as wealthy as ours, and he's in England at the time in the 1940s writing, he's saying there's no reason why anybody should be dying in the street or starving, something like that. We have enough to share with people who are on the verge of starvation. But he distinguishes his warning really is against an expanded welfare state, because the Labour Party of his day in England, when he was at Cambridge University, wanted a greatly expanded welfare state that would go cradle to grave. It would nationalize industry, provide for your old age retirement, no matter who you were. Nationalize healthcare, not just for the destitute and the poor, but for everybody. And so that, of course, is unsustainable, because when you tell people, okay, healthcare, retirement, all this, schools, it's going to be zero price for you. It's not going to cost you anything. Well, first of all, that's a lie, because it will cost you something through taxes. It's not that there's a zero cost, it's that the cost is hidden in your tax bill. So, yes, it's true there's no explicit cost for nationalized healthcare in England, but there is an implicit cost, and it's in your taxes. So the British obviously end up paying a lot more than Americans do for healthcare, because they pay higher taxes. The cost of it is all by the taxes. But since it is a government-run monopoly system, it's not even worse than the system in America, which itself is largely government-run and is strangled with regulation every step along the way. But it's still not 100% government-run, which makes people like Barack Obama very unhappy that it's only maybe 75% government control. And so I think that's what Hayek was talking about. The cradle-to-grave welfare state that was being advocated in his time is unsustainable, because if you tell people that there's a zero price, they're going to want as much as they can possibly get of whatever it is, health care, old age pensions. Sure, if I don't have to pay for it, I want all of it. And of course, that means in terms of supply and demand, demand shoots through the roof, through the sky, and of course, because people will act as though there are unlimited resources, but there are not unlimited resources. They have limited resources. Therefore, you'll create a catastrophe of shortages, and the government will therefore have to ration the short supply of things like health care through waiting lines, and some people will just have to do without. So it's unsustainable, is what he's saying. Providing that nobody dies in the street or starves is one thing. The cradle-to-grave welfare for everybody, regardless of income, is what he's distinguishing between. That's undoable. Well, Hayek is talking about how it's impossible for the state eliminate risk, like common hazards. What's a common hazard? Well, if I can drink too much alcohol and give myself alcohol poisoning, how can the state, how can the government prohibit that? I can eat too much and become obese and get diabetes. The state is going to prohibit this from doing this? How is that supposed to happen, is what Hayek is saying here. Life is full of risks, and government is not good at doing anything. It's not good at running a school system. It's not good at running a collection of garbage compared to the private sector. Why would you want the government to control all the risks in your life? And so that's what he's talking about. There are hazards of life that we all face, and the government cannot protect us from every contingency. I'll go back to the chat and see if there are questions there. Hopefully. Any more questions in the chat? Let's see. We've got some of these big long quotes in there. There's nothing more in the chat. I'll do my Q&A. Okay, I'll just fill just two questions on Q&A. Let's see if there's another one. And here's a question of Sam Chick. At the end of Chapter 8, Hayek comments on how the new socialists adopted certain liberal ideas while advancing socialist and inherently anti-liberal policies. What parallels do you see to today's situation? Well, socialists adopting liberal ideas, since I work in academia, I see a lot of academics pretending to be proponents of free speech and academic freedom, while at the same time they do everything they can to stifle free speech and academic freedom on their campuses. It's almost impossible to get hired in many disciplines if there's any inkling that you're not a leftist. If you have anything on your resume that shows that you might be a conservative or God forbid, a libertarian, it will kill your chances of getting a job. Years ago, and I could tell a story about this, and there was a job opening at a different university where I was teaching for an endowed chair in journalism. And so I knew a guy who had been a newspaper reporter, a very successful newspaper reporter, a book author. He had worked in the government, he had worked in a news organization, very well credentialed, had a PhD in journalism. And he came to my campus and interviewed, and the provost, which is the academic vice president, later told me, I couldn't hire him. The campus feminists would throw a fist because he was a devout anti-abortion Presbyterian, and he somehow let that slip out somewhere, maybe one of his writings. I think he wrote for a religious magazine, and that's case closed, no matter what his credentials are for the academic job. His personal views on that issue would disqualify him from any job at a university, according to this academic bureaucrat. And so I see that all the time. Right? They claim to be in favor of free speech, but they're not. And also, they use the language of free speech, but at the same time, they want government planning. They claim to be pacifists or even anti-war. But they advocate all sorts of government planning and health care and everything else, and they don't seem to realize that it requires a lot of coercion to have government planning. So, and coercion, of course, by government is not pacifistic. It's the use of force to force people to do things that they don't want to do. And the campus leftists don't seem to understand that. Or if they do, they're just evil. Let's see. Cam Ray says that if you have a military history degree, you're a warmonger. Not necessarily. There are a lot of people who have been to war who are some of the biggest pacifists and the biggest anti-war people who not only have degrees in war, but they've been in war. And so that's kind of ridiculous. I'll go back to the chat and see if we have another question or two in the chat. Well, we can call it a night. If the questions are drying up, we can call it a night for the road to serfdom here. We seem to be slowing down. There's one more question here I see from A.J. Scherer. It seems societies today tend to move towards socialist ideas instead of freedom. Is this human nature? Well, Thomas Jefferson, one of Jefferson's famous quotes is that the natural tendency of things is for government to gain ground and for liberty to yield. And he thought that was the natural tendency of things. And in a democracy, one of Murray Rothbard's favorite political philosophers, American political philosophers, was John C. Calhoun. And his book, A Disposition of Government, has among its themes what we call libertarian class theory. He argued that there are two basic classes in society, and they're not Marxian classes. They're not the working class versus the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. None of that. It's the class of people who are net get more from government than they pay in taxes. We call it the tax-consuming class. then you have the net tax paying class, people who pay more in taxes than what they get in any kind of benefits from the government. And Calhoun describes in great detail in this book, A Disquisition on Government, which is online, I believe, that it's the nature of politics that the tax-consuming class will overwhelm and outnumber the tax-paying class. And that's where we are in the United States today. And it wasn't always that way. But that's a good reason why Calhoun believed that a written constitution alone would never be sufficient to constrain the tax-consuming class. It might take decades, he said, but they will eventually overwhelm the tax-paying class in a democracy. That's why he advocated such things as what he called it, the concurrent majority. If, say, the people of a state or a group of states decided that a particular federal law was unconstitutional, he said they should take it into their own hands and vote to nullify that law and not enforce it within their states. And his thinking was also that if the federal government knew that some law that they passed would just simply not be enforced by a large part of the country, they wouldn't waste their time passing such laws. It would be a waste of their time. So Calhoun saw the existence of this type of voting by concurrent majority, as he called it, by states or group of states, as something that would deter bad or unconstitutional legislation in the first place. We never adopted that. We did have a long history of nullification in America prior to the Civil War, but we never adopted the Calhoun system. But that's a scholarly source of this information of why Jefferson believed that the natural tendency of things was for government to gain ground and liberty to yield. And I will go back to the chat and see if there's anything else there. Sam Chick again, I see, says on economic interdependence, Hayek talks about the inevitable and gradual enlargement of government interference once a degree of socialism is infused into an economy. In what ways does this prove true when comparing Western states from Hayek's day to today? Hayek was kind of conflicted here. He was sort of more optimistic about democracy. Not necessarily from the road to serfdom, but from other things I've read of Hayek's. He had a little more faith in democracy than certainly more than Rothbard or more than me, in that if government got too out of control in terms of just abandoning constitutional constraints, Hayek thought there would be eventually a revolution, a peaceful revolution at the voting booth, where people would come to their senses, the young people would educate themselves and do something about it. And who knows, he may ultimately be right, you know, if there's anything to the Ron Paul revolution educating millions of young people, mostly in the literature of liberty, you know, this could happen. But that's what his thinking was. And so, but as of now, what we've seen is you give the government an inch and it will take 10,000 miles in terms of getting it its powers. And so, of course, the government long ago in the U.S. and other democracies gave themselves the ability to interpret their constitutions. And so, to the extent that constitutions place limits on the powers of government, once we allow the federal government itself to be the sole arbiter of constitutionality through its own courts, the Supreme Court, then it wasn't very long when it came to the conclusion that there are very few, if any, limits on its powers. And that's basically what the Supreme Court has done for the past 70 or 80 years, in basically rubber stamping just about anything that the government ever wanted to do legislatively. And so I think that's the consequence of letting a little bit of socialism in. And it's kind of like being a little bit of pregnant. There's no such thing. You're on the road to serfdom, in my opinion. Okay, well, we seem to be drying up with the questions. I'll have to make one more shot at Q&A here on the screen. Well, that's about it. I think we'll call it a night then. The questions seem to have dried out. And thanks again for participating. I hope you learned a few things. I know some of you did, judging by the good questions. lot of you are reading the Road to Serfdom and I think enjoying it and learning a lot from it too. So I'm thrilled to see that, and we'll continue. We don't have a class on the 4th of July because a lot of Americans take a vacation on that week to celebrate our War of Secession against the British Empire. And so I'll see you in 2 weeks in class, and we'll finish it up, 2 more classes. Have a good night.